Okay, welcome to You Talking with Greg. I'm super excited today. I'm here with Bernardo Kastrup, the executive director of the Essentia Foundation, work leading a modern renaissance in metaphysical idealism. He's got his doctorate in philosophy and computer engineering. He's popping all around the web and showing us that we're all just mind rather than matter, and offering a really set of fascinating, compelling arguments. And I've been tracking him some and then really got interested in his ideas as he dialogued with John Verbeke, who's a good friend of mine. Bernardo, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here, Greg. It's a pleasure.
It's a real honor. I really appreciate the depth and richness and the breadth that you bring to these conversations. So I'll say that right up front. So maybe we can just start a little bit with, I am a clinician by training. So one of the things I like to do is get people's narrative stories about kind of how they evolved and found themselves into the situation that they are currently in with the worldview that they have. So I'll open with that and offer you an opportunity to kind of just share with our audience a little bit of the story that got you to where you are in analytic idealism.
Sure. My original background, childhood passion is electronics, computer engineering. That's where my first PhD is on. I never really abandoned that passion. I still restore and fix old computers and design little computers that get sold by computing museums in Europe. And that has, over time, led me into philosophy, because there was a period of time I worked with AI, artificial intelligence. And of course, it's impossible as an AI researcher to not wonder, if you build a machine that is intelligent, can it also be conscious? If it is processing data in an intelligent way, is that data processing accompanied by experience like it is in our brains?
Right.
And if not, what do I need to do to get that to happen? So I struggled with this latter question for a few years until realizing that
it's not an easy one.
It's the wrong question to ask.
All right.
It's to borrow from a philosopher of science I like, it's like asking what's the marital status of the number five. It's the wrong question. Of course, you don't have an answer. You're not asking a well-formed, coherent question. And that led me eventually, that conclusion for me was because I realized at some point that whatever I would change in the computing hardware, as far as structure and function are concerned, would get me no closer and no more farther away than what I had before when it comes to experience.
Right.
Whatever I could do only changed function and structure, not experience. Experience was like a completely incommensurable figure with the rest.
Totally.
So I realized I was asking a question of the kind, what's the marital status of the number five? So I needed to backtrack, re-examine my assumptions, and then figure out where I took a wrong turn and avoid that wrong turn, take the right turn, and then proceed. So that's what eventually led to analytic idealism, which is an alternative to the materialist or physicalist metaphysics.
Right. And then you went and got your doctorate in philosophy, right?
Yeah. Well, look, I was a sort of philosopher since I was born. Since childhood, I was asking the big questions and reading the classics. Not only the classics, even reading stuff that you hardly catch a teenager reading, like Jung. I was reading Jung. I was 14, and I was sort of,
I know Jung was influential.
Not obsessed, but I was very enthusiastic about discovering, that line of thinking, which was so alien to my little electronics mind. I play with electronics since very, very early, because electronics was my father's hobby.
Okay.
So, I don't remember not knowing what a resistor, a capacitor, and a transistor were.
Right.
Just as I don't remember not being able to swim, or ride a bike. There are these things, just don't remember life before them. So electronics was one. But I was also a philosopher in the true sense of the word since very early on. And only later I got the degrees that sort of satisfied society. But
right. Get your stamp of approval. And we're all aware of what that is. Okay. So yeah, then how about we get into the story to get to analytic idealism? What were some of the developments of this, and what kind of time frame are we talking about here? When did you always have this as an inkling? Was this this transition as you were like, oh God, I can't get to experience through computational electronic systems? And then was that a key? When about was this? And then tell us a little bit about how the analytical idealism framework evolved.
When I was a child and a teenager, I was not busy with the question, you know, can these electronics be conscious? I was just having too much fun with it, you know, playing computer games, programming stuff, hacking into the computers my parents got me, changing things. And the question was not part of my radar scope. It was not on the radar. Later on, I graduated very early with my master's. I was 22, and 2 days after I graduated, I landed at CERN to work there as a scientist.
Right, of course.
I was helping develop the data acquisition system for the ATLAS detector, which is part of the LHC.
Right, Large Hadron Collider.
Experiment, the Large Hadron Collider. To be specific, I was working on a data acquisition system for the calorimeter, which is the main detector of the ATLAS experiment.
Okay.
And there the question began to arise because, you know, at CERN back in 96, when I started there, there was no question of using AI in the data acquisition system. Because what the data acquisition system needed to do, it needed to recognize in real time whether an event measured by the detector could be new physics or was just old physics. And it needed to throw away the old physics because, you know, the thing produces many terabytes of information per second, and you cannot store it all. It's impossible to store it all. So you have to throw away over 95% of it, but you want to make sure that you keep the data that can give you a Nobel Prize.
Hey, that's
you don't want to throw that away.
You don't want to throw that away.
So you need to make a decision in like 25 nanoseconds. Is this new physics or is this old physics? And the physicists, you know, they used their knowledge of the physics to make that decision. So in the data acquisition system, we had to use physics knowledge. I had to understand physics to program and build the thing to make that decision based on human understanding of physics. But on the side, I started running artificial neural networks. On sets of data that were already recognized by physicists.
Okay.
Physicists knew whether this data is an electron or a jet or something else.
Right.
Started training an artificial neural network to make that recognition. Mm. And I could show that the neural network was just as good as the physics-based algorithm.
Right.
But of course, it was not used because physicists, you know, neural networks back in the 90s were black boxes. Still are to a large extent, less so than then. But they didn't know what it was doing. So it doesn't matter what the results are. They weren't comfortable. But I was doing that in my own time. And then I started asking myself, you know, if these neural networks can operate as intelligently as a physicist to recognize so quickly such complex data, would it be conscious too? And if not, why not? That's what started the thesis. I was like 23 by that time.
Fascinating.
It went into my early 30s. And then certain things happening in my life in my later 20s and early 30s, together with, you know, this sort of crescendo of understanding of what I didn't know, what I thought I knew, but I actually didn't know, this acceptance of everything I assumed, but I clearly was wrong about. And then in my mid-30s, it sort of exploded into this frenzied activity to come up with an alternative worldview. Human beings are narrative-making creatures. We cannot live in a vacuum of narratives. Yep. So once you realize that your running narrative was wrong, doesn't work. Once that reality is on your face, you don't tolerate the vacuum. You cannot just throw it away and live without a narrative in terms of which you can relate to the world and to yourself. You need another one. And that's what I did. And eventually, once it was sort of more or less ready, I figured I might as well just publish it, but I did it first for myself, not to publish it.
Right. So you sort of built it in your 30s and then brought it out to the world. Would you say that you were pretty well, where it is now is pretty similar to you had it, or has it grown?
Yeah, it's pretty similar. I have different ways of explaining it now, different metaphors, different concepts, different words. To address different audiences, you know, over the years, you will learn that certain things a certain way of putting it forward resonate with some people and not with others. So you have to adapt. So I wrote many books to tell the same story in different languages, but it's the essence of it. It's simple enough, you know. Mm-hmm. You don't need to fight too long with it. Once you realize what you are doing wrong, you're halfway to doing it right, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
Once you realize what was the wrong turn, the landscape becomes a lot clearer.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you share that then in terms of how you tell the story of what the wrong turn is, and then we can get into the right turn, at least as far as analytical idealism goes?
The wrong turn was when we started replacing reality with descriptions of reality.
Right.
When we started mistaking the image of a phenomenon for the cause of the phenomenon. Mm. What the phenomenon looks like, we took for the cause of the phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Our ways to describe the world around us became the world around us in our conceptual narratives inside. Right. To make it more concrete, you know, before the birth of science, say in the 16th century, we could all perceive the world like we perceive today.
Right.
Colors, sounds, flavors, smells. It's a world of qualities around us. Qualities. The redness of red, the bitterness of disappointment. This is all a set of qualities.
Totally.
And then when, you know, when Descartes had his vision of an angel telling him that, you know, the way to make sense of the world is through measurement and number, and science began describing the world through numbers, we became number obsessed. But those numbers back in the day, you know, back in the 16th, 17th century, we still knew that these numbers are descriptions. Mm-hmm. Mass or weight in kilos, say 55 kilos, that's a description of how heavy a piece of luggage feels. Realistic, 20,000 hertz is a description of how a certain note sounds. Numbers were descriptions of qualities. Numbers are the map. The qualities are the territory. We knew that. But at some point during the Enlightenment project, because we needed to sort of fight off the church so scientists wouldn't be burned at the stake anymore, like Bruno did in 1600, we figured, you know what? The world as it is in itself is actually those numbers. It is mass, charge, spin, momentum, frequency, amplitude. And the qualities are created by our brains inside our heads. That's when we replaced the map for the territory.
Gotcha.
We figured that the quantities actually are the reality, not a description of reality. They are the reality, and the qualities somehow arise from the numbers. And that's, of course, what gives rise to the so-called hard problem of consciousness. You're trying to extract qualities from the quantities to explain experience in terms of the physical parameters of the structure and function of your brain. That is, of course, futile, because it's exactly like trying to pull the territory out of the map. Instead of recognizing the absurdity, the internal contradiction of our way of thinking, we call it a problem. And we say, well, eventually in version 2.0 or 3.0 of the map, we will be able to pull the territory out of the map. It's just that the map is bad now. No, keep trying. I will pull a chair and seat while I wait, because
you know,
good luck with that. So that was the wrong turn. We replaced the numbers for the world. We turn qualities into secondary things and quantities into primary things, while the obvious order, correct order, is the opposite. You start with qualities. Numbers are descriptions thereof.
Right. Great description. And certainly, yes, the separation from the primary qualities, which presumably then become retranslated into the things in the world that are independent of us, and then we can objectively observe their behavioral impacts. And then we have this subjective thing that adds quality to them, gets reified in a particular way. Now, what's your take on Kant? So Kant comes along, you know, and does this whole phenomena, nomina, and gives a rise to a particular kind of idealism. I'd be really curious to get your thoughts about you know, his framing and what, you know, his own Copernican revolution that basically says, actually, you know, it's phenomena that we are dealing with.
Yeah, phenomena is another word for qualities.
Uh-huh, exactly.
Because qualities are fundamentally and intrinsically experiential. If you take experience off the table, there are no qualities anymore. Qualities are precisely the qualities of experience, which philosophers call qualia. Mm-hmm. Kant realized that all we have are the qualities. And there is no denying that my perception of the world is unique to me because it's perspective dependent.
Right.
And I have a different perspective from you, not only a spatio-temporal perspective. You know, I am the only being occupying a certain volume of space at a certain moment in time. No other being is in there.
Yep.
So I have a spatio-temporal perspective that is unique, but also a cognitive perspective.
Uh-huh.
My memories, my inner narratives, the stories I tell myself, my complexes, you know, what kinds of perceptions get cognitively associated with which emotions, which then sort of devolve into a chain of associations that tell me what the world is next to just perceiving it. So that's all unique. So the qualities that you perceive are not the world as it is in itself.
Right.
So that part, physicalism got right.
Mm-hmm.
The world is not made of the qualities you perceive. The qualities you perceive are your unique perspective into the world.
Gotcha.
Where materialism got it wrong was to say, therefore, the world is not qualitative.
Mm-hmm.
No, wait a moment. The world might be qualitative as well.
Mm.
And those qualities of the world as it is in itself get translated into the qualities you experience given your specific and unique perspective into the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have different sets of qualities. So there, materialism got it wrong. But Kant tried to stay agnostic of it. He would go as far as to say, well, the qualities I perceive are my own, and I have no access to the world as it is in itself.
Right.
Because I am fundamentally locked or cooped up in my own personal perspective.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
The world as it is in itself, that thing which projects the qualities I perceive, that thing is inaccessible to me. All I have is the way it presents itself to me, given my perspective.
Right, right.
So the thing in itself, he called it the noumena, the plural of noumenon, which is the world as it is in itself. And he called phenomena, plural of phenomenon, the way that world as it is in itself presents itself to me and gets registered by my cognitive system, my qualitative screen of perception. But he remained agnostic of the noumena. He said, well, we have no access to that. All we have is our own phenomena. So it's a waste of time to speculate about the noumena.
Right.
And that was an error because he missed one very important thing that Schopenhauer corrected.
Okay.
30 years after Kant.
Right.
38 years to be, 37 years to be more precise.
I'll take your word for the precise date.
Schopenhauer corrected Kant's mistake because Kant's key epistemic argument was, I never have access to the noumena, to the world as it is in itself. I ever only have access to the phenomena, to how the world presents itself to me. There is one error in this, which Schopenhauer pointed out. Schopenhauer said, yes, you never have access to most noumena. But there is one element of the world that you do have direct access to by virtue of the fact that you are it.
Right.
In other words, you have direct access to yourself.
Right.
When it comes to you yourself, you are the noumena. You have direct access to the noumena. You don't need a mirror to see yourself.
Right.
Even if your eyes are closed and you have no sensory input, there is something it feels like to be you.
Yes.
Your emotions, your thoughts, your fantasies, your endogenous experiences that are not dependent on sense data.
Right.
So Schopenhauer realized that we are not limited to phenomena only.
Uh-huh.
When it comes to what we are, we can experience the noumena directly.
Right. And
when he looked inside, in other words, when he introspected, he realized that what he is, the thing in itself that was Schopenhauer, was what he called the will, which was his 19th century word for endogenous experiences that do not depend on sensory data.
Right, right. Okay, great. And so you're following this trail of thought with analytic idealism.
Yeah, the next step is the following. I'm still walking on the footsteps of Schopenhauer.
We're building this up to the Kastrup version, but we're doing it historically in good stead.
Yeah. So the next step is the following. This is all Schopenhauer. When I get rid of my sense perception, I am will. In other words, I am endogenous experiences. He chose the word will because volition is the archetypal example of an endogenous experience that doesn't depend on sense data. Even if you can see and hear and feel nothing, you still feel your volition.
Yes, okay.
And volition also provides an impetus to action. Mm-hmm. And because we are dynamic beings, you know, what we are in ourselves has to have an impetus towards action. And volition is how action sort of arises.
Yeah. Got it.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to me, Schopenhauer reasoned, when it comes to my noumena, it's will. But what about another person? When another person looks at me, that other person doesn't experience my will. Oh. That other person only has the phenomena in Kant's language or the representations in Schopenhauer's language.
Gotcha.
In other words, what appears on the screen of perception of that person? And what is it that appears on the person's screen of perception when that person is looking at me? Mm. Well, matter. Mm. It's my material body. Mm. So if I'm feeling sad from within, from the outside, the noumenon called sadness appears as the phenomenon called tears.
Okay.
Or contorted facial muscles.
Right.
That's the representation, the external perspective of the inner sadness. And since the matter in my body is of the same type as the matter in the rest of the universe, Schopenhauer didn't have the concept of atoms and force fields, but what he meant was, well, the atoms and force fields in my body are the same as the atoms and force fields out there. So if when it comes to me, matter is just the representation of the will, then unless I postulate an arbitrary discontinuity in nature, then matter is always the representation of the inner will. So not only when it comes to my body, but when it comes to the rest of nature too. So matter for Schopenhauer is what the will looks like when observed from the outside, always. Okay. So when it comes to your sadness, that's the matter in your tears and contorted facial muscles. But the galaxy clusters, quasars, supernovae, exploding supernovae, those two are the external representation of a universal transpersonal instinctual will that Schopenhauer referred to as the blind will. Blind because it's not deliberate, it's not reflective, it's instinctual and spontaneous in his view.
Okay.
So that's an idealist view of the world. Always mind, not your mind, not my mind alone. There is a transpersonal field of subjectivity whose activity, in other words, whose mental processes appear to our observation in the form we call the physical universe. Physicality, matter, is what mental processes look like from the outside. What Schopenhauer never clarified is how does the outside arise? If it's all mental, how did these boundaries arise that allow you to speak in terms of the inside view and the outside view?
Right.
Where does that boundary lie? And what is that boundary? How did it form? And that's where analytic idealism came with answers.
Okay. So we have the basic structural sort of metaphysical field placing will on the inside, matter on the outside. But we have this issue of like, how does that go together? And then you achieve some insights in relationship to how to bridge that gap, as it were.
Yeah. Every metaphysics faces a fundamental problem, sometimes insoluble, and in one case, not. So for physicalism is how do qualities arise from quantities? That's the hard problem of consciousness. It's insoluble because it's not a problem. You're just asking the wrong question. It's an internal contradiction of a certain line of thinking. Panpsychism faces the combination problem. If consciousness is fundamental to elementary subatomic particles, how do the fields of subjectivity, the gazillions of fundamentally separate fields of subjectivity of the elementary particles constituting my brain, how do they combine to form my seemingly unitary conscious inner life? I mean, there is something it is like to be me, but as far as I can experience, there is nothing it's like to be an individual neuron in my head, let alone an individual electron. So how do they combine to form my unitary inner life? That's the combination problem. Sure. And there are very good arguments that it too is incoherent. So insoluble, not only in practical terms, but even insoluble in principle, because it's an incoherent problem. Now, idealism, or what people are now like to call a cosmopsychism, which is just a new word for an old theory, so people can justify new academic papers and 10 years and PhDs and whatnot.
Well, we all aware of that.
It's just good old idealism. The problem is the following. If it's all one mind, how come I can't read your thoughts? And presumably you can't read mine. How come I don't know what's going on in the galaxy of Andromeda? Because it's all one mind. So that's the decomposition problem. How can a postulated universal mind seem to fragment itself into separate centers of awareness? To this problem, there is an obvious empirical solution, not even a theoretical one. It's better than just speculate conceptually about a possible theoretical solution in principle. Because the minds of many people across the world right now are splitting up into separate dissociated centers of awareness. We call it dissociation. And it can be as benign as a dissociation that you experience during a nightly dream. When you think you're embodied in your dream avatar and you think you are separate from the world around you in the dream. Well, in fact, the world where your dream avatar is, you know, walking and, and meeting people and seeing cars and buildings, those people, those cars, those buildings are actually you. It's just that they are being imagined by a part of your own mind that your dream avatar is dissociated from. And it can be as severe, dissociation can be as severe as dissociative identity disorder, which, although it's not much in the news anymore since the 90s, it didn't decrease because of that. I mean, I'm talking to a psychiatrist working here in the Netherlands, and he says, well, my practice is full of people with dissociative identity disorder.
I've seen a couple of cases in my clinical practice, so.
And until the early 21st century, many people would say, well, no, this disorder is a fantasy. It's just people trying to get attention. But since the advent of neuroimaging, we know that that's not the case. You know, you can put people in a brain scanner now, a functional brain scanner, and diagnose them based on readings. That's the work of Yolanda Schlumpf in the Netherlands in 2014. Or we know now that people who have dissociative alters that claim to be blind, if you instrument them with an EEG cap, there will be no brain activity in their visual cortex. But the moment the host personality, which is sighted, assumes control, executive control, brain activity returns to the visual cortex. And look, a blind alter has no brain activity in the visual cortex, even if the person's eyes are open. And you cannot fake that. Dissociation is literally blinding. So the argument here is that, well, there is something in nature, there is a process in nature called dissociation that is so powerful, it can make segments of one mind blind. It has exactly the effect we need to solve the decomposition problem. So what analytic idealism postulates is that, okay, at the foundation level, reality is one mind, one field of simple instinctive subjectivity, not higher level mental functions, not reflection, not metacognition, no, none of that. Just simple subjectivity, experiential in nature. And living beings are what dissociative alters of that field of subjectivity look like when they are observed from across a dissociative boundary. That's what living beings are. And that's why your brain activity correlates with your inner experience. Your brain activity is what your inner experience looks like from across a dissociative boundary. And matter in your body is what the mental processes within the dissociative boundaries of your alter look like when observed or measured from across their dissociative boundary. Huh. And the matter in the rest of the universe too, because you see, if I am an alter of the universal mind, then the difference between me from the inside and the universe outside is my dissociative boundary. So all matter I see is what the mental activity beyond the boundaries of my alter, the alter we call Bernardo Castro, look like when observed by me. Therefore, observed from across my dissociative boundary. So which brings us to the ultimate definition of what physicality is. Physicality is what mentation looks like from across a dissociative boundary, one or more. If I am a neuroscientist peeking into your brain activity with a brain scanner, then the brain activity I see is your conscious inner life, the way it looks like to me across two dissociative boundaries, your own and mine. But when I look at the moon, what I see is the representation of noumena, of a mental process in the mind of nature, observed from across one dissociative boundary, my own. And where is my dissociative boundary? Is the dissociative boundary itself also represented on the screen of perception? Of course it is. We call it our skin, the retina, our retinas, our eardrums, the mucus lining of our nose, the surface of our tongue. This is what our dissociative boundary looks like when it itself is represented also across a dissociative boundary. So under analytic idealism, all there is one mind. And what we call matter is just the result, the cognitive representations by alters that arise as a result of natural dissociation.
Is there a way to specify sort of the ontology of that mind any more than, or is that just sort of the ground of it? It's the ground of it is a simple subjectivity. Is there any way to, you know, like from a physicalist perspective, it'd be like, okay, we'll, you know, specify the universe in terms of quantum field theory in relationship to the four fundamental forces, or however, you know, you might divide that field up. And then here's the ontological specificity of that. Is there ontological specificity in this core mind subjectivity, big mind subjectivity, or however we're referring to it?
Okay, the first thing to keep in mind is that science says very little about ontology. And what it does say about ontology is by chance, because the methods of science are not about what nature is. The methods of science aim at figuring out how nature behaves, not what nature is. That's what experimentation allows us to answer. If you set up certain conditions and you wait for nature's reply, when nature replies, that's a behavior of nature. It's something nature will have done. And if you can craft a theory that predicts what nature will do under useful circumstances, then you have a successful scientific theory. All the rest, fields, elementary subatomic particles, these are all convenient fictions. These are all metaphors to allow us to think about the world in terms of these convenient fictions. But they don't necessarily mean that elementary subatomic particles literally exist as little particles. For starters, some of them don't even have mass. In the history of science, what we do is we change the convenient fictions. There's nothing wrong with that. Like Newton had the convenient fiction that gravity was an invisible force acting instantaneously at a distance. It took the French 50 years to stop laughing of Newton. Because no invisible forces acting at a distance. And we're talking about the 17th century here, the beginning of the Enlightenment. You know, this English guy, he must be on drugs. I mean, this guy, you know, he's off to the races. And of course, since Einstein, we know there is no such invisible force acting at a distance. We have a better convenient fiction now. We think of space-time as a fabric that can be bent and twisted. it's another convenient fiction, and eventually there will be one that will replace this one as well. You know, the Higgs boson, the God particle. We've seen the Higgs boson, right? No, we've never seen the Higgs boson. Oh, but we measured the Higgs boson in some way. No, we have never measured the Higgs boson. It decays before it interacts with measurement equipment. All we measure are the footprints, the trash that results from the decay of a theoretical imaginary entity we call the Higgs boson. And it's a useful fiction because it allows us to understand the world or the nature, the behavior of nature in terms of that fiction. Uh-huh. It doesn't mean that it actually literally exists. That's something that most non-scientists don't get from about science. And of course, the self-appointed science spokespeople, they worsen it. They make it really sound like science figured out what nature is. Uh-huh. No, science has very little to say about what nature is. Uh-huh. All it says is how nature behaves. So that's the first disclaimer for your question, Greg.
I can get behind that a lot. I make a lot of assertions about the nature of science and behavior that it would line up very closely with that. So I appreciate that.
So if I translate your question into what to me is more accurate language is, can we predict the behavior of this mind of nature?
It'd be certainly.
Okay. Beyond just saying it's mind, mm-hmm. because if you say it's mental in essence, you've said everything there is to say about ontology. Hmm. It's mental. That's it. And not only that, it's fundamental. It's irreducible. So you can't even explain it in terms of anything else because you can't explain one thing in terms of another forever. At some point, you have to hit rock bottom and you say, this thing simply exists. Uh-huh. So, and that's the statement of analytic idealism. You can't explain mind in terms of anything non-mind. Mind is the end of the reduction chain. You can explain everything else in terms of mind, but once you say this is mental, you've said everything there is to say. What is missing is, okay, now can we make sense of all the rest? Can we explain how I can reduce matter to mind? Well, I just did it for you. Matter is what mentation looks like when observed from across a dissociative boundary. But can we predict the behavior of this mind? Well, surely we can. It's called physics. It's called science. Analytic idealism doesn't replace science. Mm-hmm. It just provides an ontological foundation for science, a more accurate, fruitful, empirically adequate way for us to think about what the world is and derive its implications. Mm-hmm. For instance, if all is mental, if all is mind anyway, then when you die, your consciousness is not going to disappear because it's the only thing that exists. Your consciousness is a segment of the one foundation of all nature. Uh-huh. So, the implications are multiple and they're very significant. They would change our culture and life completely if they were to be internalized by a majority of the population, but they don't replace science. So what you're trying to figure out, how does this natural mind behave? Uh-huh. Let's hope the physicists will help us answer it, maybe with better convenient fictions, but with the kind of predictive behavioral theories that they put forward. Those work, they tend to work.
Uh-huh. Totally. Let's talk a little bit then about what this, okay, so what I'd like to do then is try to understand my relationship between, we'll just stay with me then, my subjectivity, and this relationship between how my subjectivity, say, evolves over my lifetime to give me my experience in relationship to consciousness in regards to this dissociative process. So I'm a psychologist, a clinician. My job is, in fact, my theoretical job is actually to solve what I call the problem of psychology. We could possibly talk a little bit about that, but really to then afford us a more comprehensive view of the human psyche and what I call human mental behavior on the outside. So when we look at sort of the way the psyche behaves or the way my subjectivity is relative to sort of its core placement and the dissociative process, when you say like I die, does my consciousness exist? What remains, what doesn't remain? How do I understand my psyche as sort of the structure of dissociation relative to the connection to, say, the pure primitive will? Can you say a little bit about those kinds of...
Core subjectivity is only one. The philosophers like to define their concepts very clearly and unambiguously, so what they say actually holds up to scrutiny. And one of the things idealists do, or cosmopsychists, whatever you want to call them, is to make sure that people understand this concept of core subjectivity.
Okay.
Core subjectivity is what would be left of you if you were to become suddenly amnesic in a sensory deprivation chamber before the first thought would arise in your mind. In other words, you have no memories, you have no perceptions, but there is still something it feels like to be you. And then your first thought arises. Now, that's already more than core subjectivity.
Okay.
That's already an excitation of core subjectivity, a particular expression of core subjectivity. But just before the first thought arises, when you wake up to find yourself totally amnesic in a perfect sensory deprivation chamber, perfectly dark, perfectly silent, what is left? It's core subjectivity.
Okay.
Core subjectivity never dies because it's what there is. It's the foundation level of nature. It's the same in you. It's the same in me. If this thought experiment would be repeated by me, I too, in a sensory deprivation chamber, completely amnesic for a moment before my first thought would arise, I would be identical to you. Not only identical, there would be no way for us to say, well, I am an identical copy. No, not even that. Because the concept of space-time is not part of core subjectivity. So there is no way to pull me apart from you. We would be exactly the same one and the same core subjectivity. When your first thought would arise and my first thought would arise, then we would dissociate. Then there would be something more than core subjectivity. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. Okay. The other thing to keep in mind is that analytic idealism forces you to reconsider our understanding of memory. If mind is not generated by the brain is just what mind looks like from across the dissociative boundary, then the notion that memories are like little computer files stored somewhere in the brain, we can throw that away, because unlike the cause of a phenomenon, the image of the phenomenon doesn't need to be complete. In other words, the image of a phenomenon doesn't need to tell everything there is to know about the phenomenon. When I look at you, I have an image of your inner mentation, but that image is not complete. You may be sad inside, forcing yourself not to cry, and I don't have access to that. I don't even know how your back looks like. So images don't need to be complete. Causes do. If the brain is an image, it doesn't need to be complete. In other words, it's not necessarily the case that you have to find memories in the brain, because an image doesn't need to be complete. And you know, lo and behold, research on memory shows that you can cut 90% of a rat's brain away and the rat may still remember how to navigate a maze. Or you can do that with planaria, these animals, you can decapitate them, remove their brains. Their brains contain several hundred neurons, but you can remove their brains and they grow a new head. And you can train planaria to find food in a very simple water maze and they remember after they are trained. Then you can cut their heads, they grow a new head and they still remember, even though you cut off their brains completely. So there is no reason for us to think that after we die, our memories, our insights, the experience of our lifetime are gone. In the same way that when we wake up from a dream, the dissociation ends, our dream avatar is dead. Our dream avatar is dead the moment we wake up. But we retain its memories. We remember the dream. We remember from the perspective of the actual mind, not the dissociated outer, not the dream avatar. But that mind inherits the memories of that formerly dissociated complex of itself. What I submit to you is that when we die, exactly the same thing happens. We don't mourn our own deaths for the same reason that we don't mourn the death of our dream avatar when we wake up. We will still remember what there is to remember about our lives, even though our bodies decompose, because the body is an image of the dissociation. If you die, that's the end of the dissociation. So, of course, the image of the dissociation will slowly dissolve. There is an echo left, which is the dead body. It's no longer metabolizing. So it's immediately not anymore the image it used to be, because there is no metabolism anymore. But beyond that, it's an echo that eventually dissolves. So the body is the image of the dissociation, including the brain. If you die, yeah, the body is gone, but your memories don't necessarily need to correlate with that image. So I submit to you that there is every chance that when we die, we are still our own core subjectivity. There is nothing else we can be. And we retain memories. There is anecdotal evidence indicating that this happens, the so-called life review and NDEs. But we will then realize that our individual agency, the agency we thought to have as individuals in the world with a name, a certain history, you know, born in that date, did that for a living and so forth. That was just a fictional narrative, just as our dream avatar is a fictional narrative of mind within mind. That will be gone. I think your personal agency as that dissociated alter is gone. Because if your body is what that agent, that dissociated agency looks like, the fact that you die implies that something happens with the integrity of that agent, right? Yep. I don't think we will still be our personal selves after we die. But I don't think we will care for the same reason that we don't care that our dream avatars die when we wake up.
So do you feel like then that that core will and then connection, would it have access to sort of the all memories across all sorts of different domains? I mean, would it then, after we die, will I have access to yours, even though I may not be me in any particular, you know, whatever deconstructed way that is?
You can answer that question. If you have patients with DID, what happens when they reintegrate?
I mean, they begin to build bridges between some of the alters.
And they have the memories of each and every alter.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to look in terms of how often and what at what length that happens. But certainly there is a you know, an increasing integration between the alters, definitely.
So I would say that's the reason we have to think that the same happens when we die. The same kind of associative bridges reform and the same kind of reintegration takes place. How far does it go? I don't know. I think the best model we have, well, we have two very good models. DID is one. It's a near perfect model, especially the dreams of DID patients. They are perfect models of reality because alters can see and interact with each other within the same dream. That's the research of Deidre Barrett at Harvard, I think. You're probably familiar with that, but then never mind.
I'm actually not particularly familiar with that, but DID is not a not something I've deeply delved into. But I've certainly worked with some patients, and I'm familiar with the concept.
That's one good model. Yeah. The other good model is psychedelics, because it turns out that psychedelics put your brain to sleep. Well, not even to sleep, because when we sleep, our brain is very active. Psychedelics deactivate your brain. They don't activate anything in your brain. We thought that psychedelics would light up brain activity like a Christmas tree. Now we know that there are now 9 years, 10 years this year, in February to be 10 years, that research repeated and replicated with multiple, by multiple groups using multiple psychedelic substances. The result is very consistent, and rock solid psychedelics dramatically reduce brain activity. They don't increase brain activity anywhere in the brain. That's an excellent model for death. Because what happens when you die? Well, brain activity ceases. So I think these two models are excellent. DID, which is a clinical approach, and psychedelics, which is a more neuroscientific approach. These are very good models to inform us about what we might expect during the process of death and after the process is complete.
Can you tell me a little bit then about how you feel this model relates to sort of a standard like big history view? You know, big history is the basic general idea of, well, we trail the evolution of complexity or complexification on the axis of time. So we get back, go back to Big Bang. We have some, you know, basic model of the universe and its sort of fundamental form, and then it differentiates and then it grows. You know, you can argue there's an ontological claim to that and saying, hey, it starts at, you know, pure energy information. I'll sometimes say that, and then it gets differentiated into the various forces, and then it emerges into particles, into atoms, and then stars, etc. And then in our little trail, we get into life, and then life goes into animals, and then all of a sudden you get us, and we're sitting here talking. So that sort of time by complexity map of behavior over, can you share a little bit about kind of your frame in relationship to that?
Yeah, I don't think analytic idealism confirms or refutes any cosmological model we have today. The only thing okay. we have to keep in mind is that cosmological models speak the language of phenomena, of representations, not the language of noumena, of the thing in itself, because that's how we think. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about, you know, Big Bang and inflation mm-hmm. and, you know, quantum breaks in the uniformity of the early universe, leading gravity to clump things up and generating sure. the first stars, these narratives are valid. In essence, something that would have corresponded to these representations of stars and galaxies, something corresponding to that did happen.
Okay.
Because there was no life, there was no dissociative boundary, so there was no one perceiving stars. Uh-huh. In other words, insofar as stars are just the contents of perception, there were no stars. Uh-huh. But the thing that would have looked like a star, had somebody alive been there to witness uh-huh. it, that thing did happen. That thing okay. did occur. Mm-hmm. In other words, the essence of our cosmological models are not invalidated by analytic idealism. And they aren't confirmed either. Mm. So we can stick to all that. And then, you know, the next interesting thing to talk about in the history of the universe, well, first is how did everything come from nothing? Okay, that point, we can talk about that. The next interesting point is the origin of life, because that's when representations began. That's yep. when the first dissociative boundary arose. And there was subjectivity inside and seeming objectivity outside. That's okay. when it first happened. Uh-huh, uh-huh. In my language, that's when the universal mind dissociated for the first time.
Okay.
If you look at the best knowledge we have of evolutionary history, you will find out that the first living organisms were, if they had mind at all, which I'm sure they did, but I'm saying if, because it's not commonly agreed by all concerned that the early life had mentation. Mm-hmm. Materialists would say you require a complex nervous system. You need to be at least a vertebrate to have a chance to have mentation. I think that's nonsense. I think even simple bacteria have...
lots of different definitions of mentation, I will say.
Conscious in their life, qualia, yeah. phenomenality. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But everything we know tells us that those simple organisms did not have higher level mental functions. They are not capable of reflection, of introspection, of explicitly accessing the contents of their own minds, of self-awareness, a conceptual understanding of the self as separate from the world in which the self lives, metacognition. None of that was there. Their behavior betrays a very instinctive, spontaneous mind. Intelligent, just look at the work of Professor Brian Ford, for instance. The lack of higher level mental functions doesn't mean the lack of intelligence. It only means the lack of metacognition, introspection, all that good stuff. But you can be spontaneously, intuitively, or instinctively intelligent, which those microorganisms actually seem to be. Now, amoeba know how to build vases using mud particles from the bottom of the lake where they live, and they use it as houses. And paramecia know how to run away from danger and look for food. But they don't have this higher level mental function. So in this cosmological history, I would say dissociation is what enabled higher level mental functions, namely metacognition. It's what enabled metacognition to arise in the universe. It was what enabled this mind of nature for the first time to contemplate itself and say, this is what I am. Okay. This is what I am doing. Uh-huh. I understand it now. Now I have a level of introspective insight that allows me at least to describe to myself what I'm doing, as opposed to being locked and drowned in the flow of pure instinct, which Schopenhauer called the blind will. There is more than instinct in the universe now. There is us, maybe some other advanced primates, cetaceans, and pachyderms, maybe. But in any case, a small subset of the animals evolved on this planet have this ability to metacognize. Carl Sagan brilliantly, intuitively already said, we are the way nature can know itself. Because the word knowledge, even in Schopenhauer's sense, already entails at least some degree of metacognition. To know something entails an awareness that you are the knower in some way distinct from the thing known.
Sure.
Otherwise, you're just experiencing. You can experience without knowledge, but knowledge already entails some degree of metacognition. And I think life is what enabled metacognition to arise in the universe, because it created this evolutionary gameplay, which forces cognitive systems to become more complex, to evolve more functions in order to survive. Otherwise, why would the mind of nature evolve higher level mental functions? There's nothing going on that would stimulate that teleological arc, so to say. And life has enabled that. And I think that's what makes our existence meaningful in the great plan of things. We are not here for nothing. As Jung said, life is sacrificial. We are here to serve a higher order of things. And that higher order is not metacognitive and reflective like we are. It's instinctive. But it is the essence of what we ourselves are. We are giving ourselves answers.
So would you say sort of like two jumps, one at the level of from sort of the universal mind field or whatever that's, you know, we normally point to as matter from a physicalist perspective or whatever, and then you get the jump to life, and that is sort of the first layer of dissociation, if I'm hearing you, and then over time you get this sort of reflective, self-reflective, whatever capacity on the mentation itself. So would you say those are like two foundational leaps, as it were, in the stack of consciousness, or however you want to term it?
Yeah, I think clearly the mental function of the universe had to evolve enough complexity, enough structure for dissociation to happen in the first place.
Okay.
When you talk about humans, dissociation usually happens in a very complex cognitive context, usually involving trauma. It doesn't just happen when you're having fun. There's a very complex cognitive context that is necessary for dissociation to happen. And I think the cosmological history of our universe, you know, how the singularity eventually led to enough complexity and differentiation in the forms of stars, planetary systems, and galaxies for life to be able to arise. I think you can tell that same story from a first-person perspective or a noumenal perspective or the perspective of the will, which is something akin to thoughts complexified over time. Time is our own cognitive creation, but we have to speak the language of time, otherwise I can't open my mouth and say anything. The thoughts of the universal mind complexified to a certain point. So that's the first foundation.
Okay.
With that complexity in place, dissociation arose. That's the
Pause you just a second? Whitehead talked about sort of a pan-experientialism. It's close to panpsychism, but it's different. Do you have any thoughts about that in terms of sort of pointing to what you're pointing to, or do you feel like that's kind of different?
I think constitutive panpsychism, the idea that elementary subatomic particles are conscious as opposed to being in consciousness, I think that's demonstrably wrong, both conceptually and empirically. It just doesn't work. Now, so the question now is, was Whitehead's process philosophy an instance of constitutive panpsychism? If it was, I think it doesn't work. But do I know if it is or isn't? No, because I don't understand process philosophy.
Okay.
I think Whitehead, just like Hegel, was a champion of obscurantism. And when I read him, it's like he wants to have the cake and eat it too. So whatever he says is happening, he turns around and says, well, but actually it's not happening. So at some point you throw your arms up and you say, so what do you actually mean, for God's sake? I don't know what he actually meant.
Okay, gotcha. No, very good. But it, But I do want to be clear about this sort of this move. So into life is one shift, right, of the first sort of systematic dissociation into a particular kind of, the consciousness or mind shifts at that level or mentation. And then there's another shift on top of that. And that relates maybe to self-consciousness and metacognitive process on top of that, which may be present. We see evidence for self-awareness in a number of other animals. And then, of course, in us, we're pretty recursively analytic about who we are over time and all of that.
This shift to metaconsciousness is a relatively recent mystery. It's probably 30 to 50,000 years old.
Okay.
And it's in the top five greatest mysteries in science and philosophy today. There is a book by Ian Tattersall, Masters of the Universe. Uh-huh. It's about, paleontology, the evolution of humankind and our cognitive abilities. And there is a point in the book where Tattersall says, the only reason we have to believe that such a jump into metacognition could have happened at all is that obviously it did happen.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because you see, we are anatomically what we are today for about 200,000 years. Uh-huh. So our ancestors of 50,000 years ago were identical to us organically.
Sure.
But they were incapable of symbolic reasoning. Uh-huh. In other words, metacognitive thinking, the ability to replace the contents of your own mind with labels pointing to them, like words.
Sure.
Conceptual reasoning.
Everybody familiar with the you talking world knows a lot about this. Absolutely.
Okay.
So, yeah, 100%.
So that jump happened for reasons that we don't understand because organism was already there.
I actually think certainly you talk argues that we actually do understand this. It's got a whole frame for understanding this.
Okay. So from Ian Tattersall's point of view, the organism was in place for this to happen already 200,000 years ago. Uh-huh. But then it didn't happen for 170,000 years. Why did it not happen if all the required elements were already there? That's the first question. Mm-hmm. The second question is, why did it happen at all? Because it happening didn't improve our survival chances since we didn't use it for 170,000 years. So why did it get fixed in our genome? These are great mysteries. And if you understand metacognition, you do realize that it only pays off in a culturally rich society.
Uh-huh.
Metacognition before that, if you're just running from the tigers and hunting wildebeest, there is absolutely no reason for metacognition. Your brain will just consume more energy. You need to eat more. If anything, you will stand a lesser chance of survival.
Sure.
Metacognition only gives us an advantage in a complex cultural context where language is beneficial.
Totally.
And that context was not there because you have a chicken and egg situation. So, the story of how we became metacognitive, I think it's most beautifully narrated in symbolic ways in the first book of the Bible, in Genesis. Mm-hmm. The fall of man, the eating of the tree of knowledge, when Adam and Eve realized that they were naked.
Yep.
That's the fall into metacognition. And
I agree.
From the garden, it's the beginning of suffering because it's through metacognition, the explicit recognition of ourselves as a subject separate from a monstrous world, a subject that can regret the past and be anxious about the future. That's how birth arises. Now, we pay a huge price for this. All human suffering is the price we pay. We don't know how and why it happened. In terms of evolutionary paleontology, it's a great mystery. Maybe you have the answers. You have to talk to Ian Tattersall.
I'm pretty clear on what, I've been writing about this for a while. I'm pretty clear on what the answer is, but anyway.
Mm-hmm. So in principle, arguably, it's a mystery, and certainly we pay an enormous price for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the game we have to play is, the price we have to pay, there is no getting rid of suffering, but let's listen to the people who kept the light going when we were in the darkness of behaviorism in the mid-20th century, people like Jung, Paul Tillich, Viktor Frankl, who told us that, you can't get rid of suffering, but you can more than compensate for it with meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what behaviorism and materialism is robbing us.
I totally agree.
They are robbing us of meaning. So, and I think, yeah, that's what philosophy should do to give us back the meaning that was stolen from us.
Wow, that's beautiful. I totally agree with that. And certainly, I'm a big critic of what Ken Wilber labels the materialistic flatland view, and we're all a bunch of jigs chemicals. That's a disaster. It sets the stage for all sorts of different problems. But I will say that I'm pretty clear about the transition in terms of metacognition. That's kind of the whole—
Do you want to enlighten me?
Sure.
I would be curious.
So for me, so I'm a clinical psychologist. My own journey starts in the world of psychotherapy. So psychotherapy, you get all these different approaches, psychodynamic, analytical, Jungian approaches, behavioral approaches, cognitive. The best of the best, I thought that cognitive behavior was like empirically supported when I was an undergrad. That's what they told you. And then you get into it, it's like, that's basically bullshit. The best of the best get good outcomes. Their mastery and charisma with it. The shitty people across all domains get lousy outcomes. Most people get adequate outcomes. I was convinced that there were really key insights to be had across the major paradigms, major schools of thought, both at the individual level, down into the neuroscience level, and up into the systems level. The question for me was, well, why don't they all sing together? Why do they create so much noise? And why do I have to choose what my orientation is inside a school of thought when it's clear they are all partial truths that are biased against in particular way that aspectualize, to use John Verbeke's term, a particular set of behavioral patterns, as it were? And then why don't they get harmonized so they make music instead of noise? That was my basic concern, because I'm a big picture kind of coherentist, as it were, in terms of my. And then I made the jump, and it was like, well, if modern biology is relatively well organized, at least Western biology, we can get into all sorts of different debates, but hey, you're, the circulatory system and the reproductive system and all of the different systems that I study by specialists all cohere in relationship to a basic model of human biology and pathology. And we get a reasonable, no one competes and says, oh, the key is your gut. versus the key to circulatory system versus muscles. And I was like, no, it's all an organ system that's organized by human biology. So then I asked the question, well, why don't we organize our psychological therapies to the science of human psychology? Okay. And I was trained originally as a methodological scientist, basically. And I thought that we kind of knew what that was, and we frame it as a methods. And then when you ask, like, what do we mean by psychology, you realize nobody knows what the fuck we mean by psychology. Okay, psychology is a completely broken discipline at whatever ontological referent the mental actually means. So ultimately, I started on a journey. I actually got into what's called evolutionary psychology. You probably heard of that. And then trained myself in evolutionary theory, sociobiology, behavioral ecology, ethology, which I hadn't been trained in, which is really unfortunate. But then mastery in relationship to that, I was tracking then this evolution problem. And evolutionary psychology doesn't have any good solution for the metacognitive problem. Okay, it doesn't. But I stumbled on a way to frame it. Essentially, the story is this. So we get into our pre-self-awareness ape stage, which we see in the chimpanzees, etc. You do the Gallup experiments and you get mirror self-recognition. Okay. And then we can track actually the evolution of hominid evolution, which is much more group coordinated. Michael Tomasello does a lot of good work in relationship to this, whereby pre-linguistically, we're the have a capacity for shared attention and intention. Okay. So I have a capacity to, mirror neurons probably are overshot, but essentially you and I can hook up and I can read what your attention is focused on. We can develop a shared implicit intersubjective intention, and that can allow us to what Michael Tomasello achieve an intuitive we space. Okay, so I can imagine your perspective, my perspective, and a generalized third person perspective, and then coordinate ourselves in proper relation. And empirically, you can see this in relationship to like how infants point, and very early on, human children get the idea that you're pointing at something. Other apes don't do very well with that kind of intuition. And then the syncing up capacity. So I'm going to say 500,000 years ago,
we're able to hunt together, we're able to gather together, we're able to coordinate our behavior fundamentally together. So we have an shared implicit intersubjectivity. And that really is creating a collective mind that's quite different than the other apes. And then what you get basically is the ability to symbolically tag, okay, a shared intersubjective space in the form of, you know, words. We're also engaged in music. We're also engaged in some other particular kinds of things. But we initially get a symbolic tagging function. And the symbolic tagging function increases our cognitive coordination in a particular way. But the real trick from a unified theory perspective is that you get a symbolic syntactical shift in the relationship that's going to press the language acquisition device. And what you what happens in relationship to the evolution, what then generates a very novel adaptive problem, is the evolution of propositions. Okay, so propositions set the stage for, like, instead of like their antelope, if I say there are the antelope, a proposition is a meaning-based statement that then pulls together and asserts is ought positively. Meaning it's like, now I've made a claim, okay, that can reside in your cognitive structure. And very quickly, the argument is that by making a positive claim, all right, that actually carries all sorts of implications between us, then the questioning of that positive claim comes along, okay? And we're basically the only animal that systematically asks questions, all right? So if I say there are the antelope, the positivity of that actually opens up what I call the negative space around it, all right? Which are like, maybe they're not over there. In other words, that's the analytic thing. That's bullshit, that is not true. Or it's also the case that the rabbit's over there, which is a different propositional space. And why are we investing and influencing another on this proposition when we could be, should be over there? Okay. And what that does then is the negative space, the bridge to the negative space are questions, which then function as easy cognitive gadgets. Okay. And easy cognitive gadgets is why, what, who, when, why, where. And then by throwing that, and little kids get this very early because it's a very easy little thing for the brain, why, what, how. So once you see little kids, the precocious kids, they ask all the damn time. You get the problem then through propositions of the problem of questions. And this gives rise to the question answer dynamic. Okay. The question answer dynamic
cognition.
Well, right. Now, all of a sudden, now you have, and I call this the problem of justification. Okay. The problem of justification is the propositions get placed, the questions get asked, and now we have to decide what is justifiable in relation. Okay. And the justification hypothesis says actually there are three very clear problems. One's the analytic problem, the truth claim basis of it. Okay. And then there are two real clear value problems. One value is if it's my proposition and that's part of my base investment system, all right, there are antelope. I'm a good antelope hunter, okay? And then what you get, that's the personal dynamic when my attachment to this justification, okay, in terms of what does it mean by my social influence, my place, what we do based on my own investment. And then there's the social problem, okay? The social problem of justification, if it's me and you, why are we attending to this if you and I have a dyad? If we all get together, why is this group attending to this? So then it distributes itself in social relation, okay? So the group now needs to dialogue. Each person needs to dialogue in relation. And the cool thing about this is that it makes a very clear set of, it's a reverse engineering evolutionary argument that basically says, the problem of justification then is going to require a mental organ of justification, okay, that creates a particular kind of interpretive narrative relative to the subjective experience of being and relative to the social environment, okay? So it then predicts very clearly that you're going to develop a justified state of being at the ego level relative to your private experiential self and also regulate your ego relative to your public persona. And there should be very clear filtering dynamics around problems of investment, influence, and justification that should relate to these three domains of your persona, your ego, and your experiential self. And lo and behold, actually,
that social dynamics, you internalize that and you start asking questions about yourself, and that's metacognition.
So as you get socialized, then you then have to internalize the introject, okay? And that's a superego or whatever. And now you are anticipating the criticisms and approvals of others, and you carry that around to determine what's legitimized in relation.
By internalize the society, you externalize your own self. And that's how metacognition. Totally. Yeah, very interesting. Yep. I mean, this is a bit off the cuff, very spontaneous. Mm-hmm. I would love to publish a summary of this on the Essential Foundation magazine.
Oh, that'd be great. I mean, I've been publishing about this forever, but I'm in a weird space because what happened to me is I found this and then I went into this whole idea about what psychology is. And so I built this whole theory that says, hey, because what this does is it creates the dividing line between animal cognition and human cognition. And the psychology is all fucked up with that because what we study are behaviors, hey, that the scientists can see. And then we infer mental processes, yeah, whatever the hell those things are. Okay, that's what we do. And then we're like, well, you decide what the hell you mean by mental process based on your school of thought. And is it animal cognition that we're talking about? Is it human? We don't even have the dividing line. Psychology doesn't even know. And then sometimes it's behind your head. It's your experiential and we have to infer it. Or no, sometimes it's the mental behavioral patterns that we see in the world. Our system's completely screwed. I mean, our ontology.
Yeah, we can't communicate.
It's a shit show, Bernardo, I'm telling you. So then I'm like, well, actually, we can actually make sense out of this field if we draw the lines in the right way, and then we can organize these schools of thought and get them in harmony. But then that drops me in this whole unified kind of approach. It's this little arcane little section of the academy. You know, we're all broken in our fields, but I would be more, there's a lot on it, but I'd be happy to share with you.
Well, I would love that if you would be willing to contribute, I don't know, 2,000, 3,000 words.
Oh, God, of course.
For the average reader, not to jargon-based.
Follow
the rationale.
Exactly. Once you start learning the language, it's called, the overall thing is called justification systems theory, okay? And there are three parts to it, really. So one, as I told you, is the justification hypothesis. That's the idea that propositions, question-answer dynamics, create the problem of justification, and then that drives systems. Okay. So that's sort of the evolutionary, biological into psychological aspect. Then there's the psychological aspect, which gives rise to what's called the updated tripartite model of consciousness, human consciousness. And it says, hey, based on this, we should have an experiential self that nobody has direct access to except for you. You should have an ego narrator that's like trying to justify, and you should have a persona, and you should have filtering. Okay. Which is updated tripartite model, obviously superego, ego, id, but this one now puts it in an evolutionary context and then draws in all this academic research on the way the egoic narrator and the experiential self, you know, like Jonathan Haidt shit and all this other stuff, the righteous mind and persona. So then it takes human psychology and organizes that. And then what it also offers is a theory of sociology of knowledge and social constructionism. It basically says what people are doing is they're building systems of justification at the large scale level to legitimize their investment and influence patterns. And what emerges in the coordinating system, when we say, oh, what is culture, especially human culture, I actually want to use a capital C there, the networks of propositional meaning-making systems to legitimize is and ought that coordinate people. So that's the sociological layer that it points to. So justification captures then sociological, social constructionist view, the human psychological view, and then puts it in a naturalistic evolutionary frame, and then ties that stuff together and allows you to say, oh, that's what we are. We're justifying fucking apes.
Very interesting. I, you know, maybe if you would have the time to read Ian Tattersall's book, The Masters of the Planet.
Yeah, I've skimmed that. I've skimmed a lot of books in that regard, and I've definitely skimmed it and I thought it was interesting.
He describes why he sees this as an insoluble, hardly soluble problem. And maybe you can contact him. And maybe that would be fruitful, you know, psychology and paleoanthropology enlightening one another.
Love it. Yeah, no, that'd be great. A lot of people have framed it, you know, sort of like the human mind's big bang and where does this come from and what's the genetics and, you know, what's the anatomy and why is it 250,000 years ago we looked this way and then all of a sudden it starts to pop off. And all it says is that once we tip from symbolic to symbolic syntactical into proposition then very quickly reveals quick question answer dynamics. That's a very clear adaptive problem. And then it makes huge predictions about the organization of our psyche.
Cool. So maybe that's how we came to at least ask the right questions that nature in her original state couldn't even have asked about itself.
Right. All of a sudden we started coming up with answers and then other people saying, you're a bullshitter. And now we had question answer dynamics. That's at least according to this narrative.
There you go.
Cool. So, I'd be happy to dialogue with you about that and share what I have in relationship to it. So let's come back to analytic idealism,
sorry to derail your interview.
Oh, no, that's listen, I was really hoping we'd have an opportunity to dialogue and correspond and think about this in terms of,
because I've been very keen on your critiques of physicalism. I have the exact basically same sense. And I'm trying to, I really am fascinated by this whole dissociation thing. I essentially see, for me, my ontology of the universe kind of drops into what I call energy information fields. Okay, so like going through matter, I am kind of a naturalist like John. John Verbeke and I have done a lot of shit together. We're basically got the same basic, you know, ontology or whatever. Really very similar. So, but I do take this kind of naturalistic evolutionary view, we go back down, but I'm like, I'll drop it into this energy information field, which has a lot more mentation-like features to it than like billiard ball shit, that's for sure. Okay. So in that sense, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm very close to analytic idealism in some ways, in the sense that I hear the big mind and I feel the resonance. There are a couple of pieces that I'm still struggling with, but I really, really like it. And I really like your critique. So what I'm curious now is, how do you feel like analytic idealism is being received? Kind of where is it, and what's your where are you headed with this, and all of those kinds of things? I wanted to get some reflection on.
Look, let me first make a disclaimer. There is very, very, very little new in analytic idealism. The essence of it has been known, I don't know, for 3,500 years since the Aryans were in the Indus Valley. Right. And by the way, the Aryans were not an ethnic group. It's a way to refer to a certain geographical population. So gotcha. Before people start accusing me for hinting at racism, I don't even acknowledge that human races exist.
Right. Well,
and dog races do exist. You know, a bug is different from a Great Dane.
Right. Right.
But, you know, a black man and a white man, they are
What that actually means in relationship to the rainbow of human diversity plus the overlap, I hear I'm with you.
But anyway, I think since, you know, what happened in the Indus Valley 3,500 years ago, we've known this. But we periodically get caught in different fashionable narratives. Mm-hmm. And we sort of lose the thread for a little while, only to come back to it, having taken a step further up in the spiral. Mm-hmm. So the spiral always comes back to the same place, but a little higher because of the mistakes we make. Mm. And of course, an overemphasis on subjectivism, which plagued the late Middle Ages, was something that needed to be corrected. But when you apply the correction, the pendulum sort of moves too far out to the other side. Mm. So by mid 20th century, we figured, well, there is no subjectivity at all.
Right, you know? It's all just an epiphenomenal illusion. Yeah. Wait a minute, what the fuck happened there?
This absurd story has three names today, and it's still going on today. It's called, one of them is called eliminativism, consciousness doesn't exist at all. The other one is illusionism, consciousness is an illusion. Well, but wait a moment, illusion is already an instance of consciousness? So, but anyway, and the third one is identity theory. Which is a sort of more nebulous form of eliminativism. It says, no, consciousness exists, but it is neuroactivity. Like, what the hell do you mean? I mean, you want to eat the cake and have it too, and, you know, and confuse us all with conceptual convolutions, you know?
Right.
Trying to cheat yourself into accepting something absurd. So this kind of mental pathology, and I'm very open about it, I think philosophy suffers from mental pathology. We keep on trying to fit a square cog through a round hole.
Hey, I'm a clinician. I can help you with that. I totally agree. Let's diagnose these fuckers.
So you get this ludicrous cases like Danny Dennett and, you know, Keith, forgot his, you know, the pupil of Danny Dennett who is still insisting on this absurdity. Yeah, so you get this sort of, you know,
pathological... I said like the consciousness explained absurdity. You're talking about like
Explained. If you read that book, you realize that he doesn't explain consciousness at all.
No, it's explained away. Certainly, that's my critique. It definitely is like, okay, you just erase what you were trying to do. I went around a loop, and I do not feel like I'm well. You know, I mean, it's a fascinating book, but it's
fascinating because it's so reflective of how pathology, suffixed by the letters PhD, can be so complex, while actually being just the nonsensical, simple bullshit that it started with.
Exactly. It's just layered. It's some weird dissociative looping. That leaves people in just to the abyss.
There is a statement I will never forget in that book. I read that book in 1991. It's been a while,
yeah,
you know.
I think that's where it was published, yeah.
Yeah, and there is a statement I never forgot. I think I can quote literally. The way to deal with this first person humbugs is to ignore the first person perspective and adopt only the third person perspective. I mean, the kind of kenosis of emptying out of everything that you are in an attempt to fit reality into a theory that your master convinced you of during the darkness of the 60s is just spectacular. How far one goes. One goes to the point of basically eliminating oneself. Wow. It's a kind of, it's a secular kenosis, as powerful as the divine kenosis of the Bible.
I mean, love it. Love
it's religious actually, in nature.
So this you talking with Greg has a, it's what it seeks is it seeks a coherent naturalistic ontology that can revitalize the human soul and spirit in the 21st century. That's how I frame this podcast. And I try to sneak that quote in during not always successfully, but what you just did there just inspired me to remind folks of that quote, because that was an unbelievably brilliant articulation of exactly the pathology. So I really appreciate that.
It is pathological. And look, I don't mean this in an offensive way. I mean, Keith, I forgot his second name. It's my fault. I have tinnitus and I take medication for tinnitus that impairs my short-term memory. I forgot his second name, but that's it's my fine. Fault, not his. I think he's a, you know, he's a visible figure. I'm not demeaning him by not remembering his second name, but he takes exception with me because I accuse him of being pathological. So he doesn't even want to debate me, but I don't mean it in a disrespectful way because I am pathological. I suffer from anxiety. I have done things in my life that I look back and I go like, man, you gotta be really, really screwed up in your head to go about things the way you did. So I welcome the label pathological to aspects of myself. So I'm not doing to them anything I don't do to myself. But of course, that's not how I get understood.
Sure. Well, yeah, I understand. And certainly for me, I have a term called the enlightenment gap. Enlightenment gap refers to the failure of us to generate a coherent synthetic philosophy that properly situates matter and mind on the one hand, and scientific relative to social and subjective knowledge on the other, and just gives us rise to a chaotic, fragmented pluralism, and certainly the physicalist attempt to try to sense make on that. I find that to be pathological. So I'm sort of with you there.
The physicalists have to tie themselves into knots to salvage any semblance of plausibility for what they have to put forward. And it's becoming ludicrous. That whole story is becoming ludicrous. And look, it's not only amongst philosophers. There is a physicist I have great respect for. And I even like him as a person. That's Carlo Rovelli. And I endorse his understanding of quantum mechanics called relational quantum mechanics.
Oh, I like relational quantum mechanics. Yeah,
I don't even like to call that an interpretation because I don't think it's an interpretation. It's an acknowledgement of what quantum mechanics means, which by the way, now has extremely strong empirical substantiation. I think Rovelli is completely right when he says all physical entities are relational. Yes. They do not have standalone existence. They arise from relationships. So I'm totally with him there. I think that's obviously the case. That's what laboratory experiments have been telling us for 40 odd years now. And you cannot dismiss those experiments anymore. Really? All the loopholes have been closed. But then, and he's on record saying that, my criticism towards him is, well, if you say all physical entities are relational and there is nothing other than physical entities, then you are immediately running into infinite regress. Because, if physical entities are relational, then they are relationships. So what is in relationship? Well, it can only be other relationships because all that exists is the physical. Uh-huh. And okay, but what are those meta relationships then? Well, it's relationships between other relationships. So you have meta-meta relations and meta-meta-meta relations, and it's turtles all the way down. And Rovelli is on record when I confronted him with this saying, well, I actually think it's turtles all the way down. I mean, here is a champion of the Enlightenment basically saying, yes, I am committing one of the classical logical fallacies. And I think reality is exactly this. Huh. I mean, how do you wrap your head around that? And he appeals to Nagarjuna saying, no, reality is empty. There is nothing. And my read of Nagarjuna is there is no thing, which is different from nothing.
Nothing, sure.
It's different from turtles all the way down. But you know, that's what people who think, and the other avenue that they escape from this, and I'm not going to accuse Ravelli of that. I know this from private conversations with unnamed parties, but the other avenue of escape is to say, well, Bernardo, maybe you are right. Maybe it's not turtles all the way down. Maybe there is a substrate behind the physical, but why can't I call that physical as well? Well, then you're making physicalism unfalsifiable by word redefinition. Uh-huh. You're basically saying, whatever reality is, I will call it physical. So physicalism is true. Duh. So if reality is mental, you just call that physical, and then physicalism is true. I mean, you're not helping anybody by doing that. You're pretending you didn't lose the discussion. What everybody understands by the physical is stuff that can be described with the numbers mass, charge, momentum, spin, frequency, amplitude. And by definition, all of this is relational. So whatever layer of reality has standalone existence underneath the physical, it is by definition not physical, because it's not any of these things that we understand by the word physicality. But no, they would just redefine the word and say whatever it is that exists, even if it's not physical, according to the general understanding of the word, we will nonetheless call it physical. Yeah, I mean, that's the degree of the pathology required for saving physicalism. We just cannot take a step back and realize that we made a simple wrong turn. And in the early days, people knew that. I mean, Denis Diderot, one of the fathers of the Enlightenment, one of the two co-authors of La Encyclopédie, the founding document of the Enlightenment project in the 18th century, he's on record saying, well, materialism doesn't actually quite work, but we need it in order to fight the church. So at least he knew. But now we don't know.
We don't know. We lost what we didn't know.
Yeah, something happened.
And now we know.
In the late 19th century, some kind of fluid compensation happened in the minds of the intellectual elite that they preferred closure over transcendent meaning. And they completely lost sight of what they knew when materialism was invented. And here we are today.
Yeah. How do you feel like the reception is these days? And do you feel like tides turning, or at least people are wondering, or where do you think idealism relative to physicalism is in the kind of the continuum of unfolding?
There is movement. Yeah. When I started this, 15 years ago, Neo-atheism was still an active movement and people were defending materialism actively. Today, you cannot find a person who is willing to get into a debate and actively promote physicalism. Maybe Daniel Stroyar is the last one who is still honest enough and to understand the complexity of the task and still be willing to try to save it, but you cannot find anybody willing to defend physicalism. I can find people willing to attack analytic idealism. I'm always on the defense, which I love because it gives me an opportunity to elaborate on what I have to say.
Sure, it's lovely. Well, we love that as academics, scholars.
Open invitation. If any well-known academic wants to debate me by solely attacking analytic idealism and not defending physicalism, I am in for it. Okay, I'm not going to attack physicalism. But you cannot find somebody willing to defend physicalism today. So things are shifting, but I don't think there will be a society-wide, a civilization-altering shift in my lifetime.
Right.
I think
these things take for a long, long time, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's what history shows. Every major philosophical step forward in history was seemingly debunked in its own time, only to be rediscovered much later. And then we change our views and we wonder, why were those people so ignorant back in the day?
Totally.
And of course, the same will be said of us 100 years from now. No,
it's a chronic condition.
Yeah, these people are crazy materialism. Of course, it doesn't work. It's nonsensical. It's internally contradictory, let alone empirically inadequate. But I have no doubt the shift will happen. And I have no doubt it's happening very slowly. I just don't think that there will be any statue of any analytic idealist during my lifetime now. Oh, like that.
Okay. Well, you can pull that out.
My relationship with nature today, Greg, is such that I take responsibility for my task, but I do not take responsibility for the end result.
Yeah, fair enough. That's reasonable.
So that's my deal with nature. Yeah, that's my deal with the diamond. I do the diamond's beating, but I do not take responsibility for the outcome because it doesn't depend only on me.
Totally. Totally. One last question I had for you, and then we can see if there's anything else and begin to wrap up. So you had a long series of conversations with John Verbeke. I followed those and enjoyed them. Can you share a little bit about what you took away from that? If you had any kind of reflections after that, those two debates or things that you, grew from or critiqued on his end or shifted in your own perspective or just thought was good about it. I mean, I thought it was a really, really powerful set of engaged conversations. And so I want to thank you for that. They certainly, I spent 8 hours or however with them, and so that sells something. And a lot of people did. So since I'm really close to John, I just thought I'd ask you what your reflections were there.
It reconfirmed something I already knew, but it's one thing to know something because you arrived at that conclusion conceptually. And it's another thing to be confronted with the reality of that by direct acquaintance. So it reconfirmed something I already knew conceptually, which is when it comes to what reality is, as opposed to how it behaves, the best people to talk to are psychologists, not physicists. There is a degree of attunement with the relevant variables that physicists do not have. Physicists are so inculcated in that mindset that the scientist is totally dissociated from the subject of study. It's that view from nowhere that it is impossible for them to tune into some of the most relevant variables about the nature of existence. Because existence, whatever it is always mediated by our subjectivity.
Totally.
Even if it itself is not subjective, in essence, it is everything we can say or know about it is still mediated by our subjectivity. We do not have a view from nowhere. We are embodied subjectivities. These are the scientists. Each and every one of them is an embodied subjectivity. Everything gets mediated by their subjectivity. And physicists lose connection with their own subjectivity. They are not asking some of the right questions about their thinking process, about their criteria of judgment, of value judgments. And that's a problem. That's a problem. It gives them a sort of horse view. And they look for the keys only where the light is shining. And psychologists have, because of their daily lives, or maybe because of the dispositions innate to them that brought them to psychology in the first place, I don't know. I don't know whether it's innate or developed, whether it's cause or effect, but whatever it is, there is an attunement to the relevant variables, to the relevant questions that make them more appropriate people to contemplate what nature is. And leave nature's behavior at its more foundational levels to the physicists. I'm not meaning to take the crown from the physicist's head.
I hear you. I hear that. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's fascinating.
John reinforced.
Well, that's affirming for me as a psychologist. You know me, my justification would be like, I'll take that.
And the other thing I took from him is that it's important that we keep on talking about meaning.
Right.
It's important that we reemerge strong from the darkness of behaviorism, from Skinner's black box. It's important we really commit that to the grave of history, with a very big gravestone on top that nobody can ever remove. because we flirted with hell there. We flirted with the degree of ignorance and dissociation that that is almost unfathomable. And therefore, the work of the likes of Tillich and Frankl has to be continued. And I think John is one of one of the carriers of the light.
Beautiful. Okay, wonderful. Yes. Well, I think that those both resonate with me, I know that they, John, we deeply appreciate that. So, is there anything else that you would like us to touch on before we wrap up here? As we kind of come.
Usually have no agenda for this.
All right. Well,
go where the flow goes.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's really, I think it afforded a pretty clear articulation of your journey of analytic idealism. I'm glad we had some back and forth. I'd happy offline to dialogue with you a little bit about possible future correspondences and anything. Actually, tell me a little bit about the Essentia Foundation. I looked into it and seen several videos on that. Maybe you can give your folks, and we'll put it a link in the show notes about it. Can you tell us a little bit about that foundation?
Sure. Yeah, we started it last year. But actually, the year before that already, in the summer of 2020, we started it. We became public in January of 2021. Mm-hmm. The foundation aims at promoting idealism. Analytic idealism is one of the variations of idealism today. But mm-hmm. we want to promote the notion that reality is essentially mental. Okay. Not your mind alone, not solipsism, mm-hmm. but mental in itself. And that the physical world is just what that external transpersonal mentality looks like when we observe it. So we want to promote that idea through leveraging only the Enlightenment values. In other words, we are not going about it in a spiritual way, because this has been done for 3,500 years, uh-huh. and it should be done. That's very important. Maybe uh-huh. that's the most important of it all, uh-huh. that that continues to be done by people like Rupert Spira.
Sure.
Even my friend Deepak Chopra, who gets a lot of undeserved scorn uh-huh. from people who do not understand what he's saying, and therefore they think what he's saying is nonsense, because uh-huh. you know that's the paradox. And if you don't understand what someone is saying, either that person is stupid yeah. or you do not have the capacity to understand what they are saying.
There's that.
Which one do you think you choose? Which alternative do you think people choose? But anyway, so that's the most important. But we think we identify the gap, which is an unfortunate one. Because idealism historically is only defended from a spiritual perspective, it looks like materialism is the way to go if you choose empirical evidence and logical reasoning.
Okay.
Well, that's not at all the case. Uh-huh. Logical reasoning and empirical evidence categorically refute materialism and endorse idealism. Mm-hmm. But who's talking mm-hmm. about it? Well, not many people. So we thought we would start that foundation, put in significant resources to make clear that if you're not a spiritual person and you don't want to meditate and become mm-hmm. enlightened, you only want to use your hard-nosed reasoning and hard-nosed laboratory empirical evidence, not uh-huh. even anecdotal evidence, uh-huh. not NDEs, not mediumship, no. Just not the paranormal even. I have nothing against the paranormal, but some people do. So uh-huh. even if you discard all that and focus only on logic and reasoning, there is an overwhelming case to be made uh-huh. for idealism over physicalism. And that's what we try to talk about.
Okay, beautiful. Well, maybe we'll dialogue some more about that. I'd be happy to do that. And you're doing great work out there. It's really fascinating to talk to you. I've learned a lot about analytic idealism over the course of the last year or so, and it's been joyous. And I certainly appreciate the basic issue, if we really get down to it, and you shared this with John, hey, we need meaning and our subjective lives fundamentally matter, and we need to reconstrue our understanding to make sure we include that. So I really appreciate that message.
So thanks for having me, Greg. It's been a great pleasure.
Hey, it's been really great, and we'll be in touch in the future, okay?
Sure.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Uh-huh. Bye.